It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us at this special time because of our ongoing live coverage of the Senate impeachment debate. Joining me this week are critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. We begin with The Gentleman, a film directed by Guy Ritchie. It features an ensemble cast led by Matthew McConaughey. McConaughey plays a drug lord trying to sell off his marijuana empire to a group of billionaires.
Weed, bush, skunkamola, white widow super cheese. It's the new gold rush. This is the thin end of a very fat wedge, sir.
If it's such a fat wedge, why don't you keep it?
See, I've developed a reputation as a man who came up the hard way. You could say that there's blood on these pretty white hands. But in the new business, once legal and under the jurisdiction of the respectable umbrella of ministerial legitimacy, an enterprise like this will need a face with a clean past.
Matthew McConaughey from The Gentleman. Guy Ritchie wrote it as well as directed. Christy?
It's so fun. And just hearing that clip right there of Matthew McConaughey rattling off different names for pot, it sounds like the car ads he does where he's just sitting there and talking.
He makes Lincolns look so cool.
Right. I want to go drive one now. So, but there's a very knowing, self-aware element to that performance and to everything in this film for the good, for the better. This is a great return to form for Guy Ritchie. It's the kind of London gangster movie that he made his name with Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, and after that, Rock and Rolla. It's just a lot of fun. It's a lot of really dangerous, thuggish British gangsters who are way smarter and more verbose and more stylishly dressed than you ever could expect from them. And that's his bread and butter, is subverting your expectations of this kind of movie and of these kinds of characters. And it's just fun and it's playful. And I laughed and smiled the whole way through. The plot, I don't know if it really matters. You know, it's more of a showcase for these actors to play off of each other. And it's a terrific cast. Matthew McConaughey is this very slick drug lord. He has this whole underground pot empire. But really what is the structural device is Hugh Grant as this sleazy tabloid reporter who is trying to shake down Charlie Hunnam, who is McConaughey's consigliere, because he's got some kind of scoop for him. And there are all kinds of bit players here and there. Colin Farrell gets dragged in and he's the coach at this boxing gym. And it's just a blast. Like, it's just fun, and it's perhaps not as energetically frenetic as the early Guy Ritchie films. It's sort of in a lower key, but it is as intricate plot-wise, and it's as playful and as profane, and I had a great time.
Well, you look, all of that is true, but here's the deal. Sure, I like this movie. Well, I like it every time he's made it. And he's been making it for 25 years.
But he's really good at that
pre-smoking
movie, though.
Girl.
Oh, yeah. He's doing Snatched and Rock and Roll and all of that. And if you think about it, really, of course, Guy Ritchie, the Sherlock Holmes movies, he directed Will Smith and Aladdin, I guess last year also. Even when you look at those movies, they're still Guy Ritchie movies.
Stylistically,
mm-hmm. They're whole, all of the sort of same apparatus that he uses, he infuses into every single one of these films. Sometimes it makes those Sherlock Holmes films slightly too contemporary, if you ask me. He's just being a little too slick there, Sherlock, from 1895. Mm-hmm. So if you like what Guy Ritchie does, I suppose you're going to like this movie. Now, for me, it's all starting to wear a little thin. It's all starting, these guys, the irony in that title there, The Gentlemen, they are so not. Gentlemen, all of these guys, no matter what sort of bespoke suits they wear. The wardrobe in this movie. There are entire movies that don't have wardrobes, that don't have budgets that cost as much as the wardrobe in this movie. Not crazy about the way Guy treats women in his films.
Now,
he's married. What's her name?
Michelle Dockery.
Yeah. And she's a tough broad, mm-hmm. as we say. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still about her getting manhandled and some guy having to come in, her and Matthew having to come in and save the day. So never cared for the way Guy treated women in his movies, but that's just me.
There is a sort of retro element to some of the like the racial jokes and the misogyny in it. I wonder if Izzy trying to make a statement about how that was okay in a certain kind of film, but it's not now, or is he just trying to play loose with that and still indulge in it? I don't know. I can't decide.
You know, I've interviewed Guy Ritchie many, many times. You know, Guy Ritchie is a manly, manly, manly man. And it's simply not going to be told what he can do or say or anything like that. So I think he's being pointed in that way when he talks about that stuff in those films. He always sort of hedges his bets with that stuff. Mm-hmm. Colin Farrell, fun role, playing the sort of mentor to all of these young men, a few of them black men, at this boxing gym. And they're all just these kids, and he's taught them how to do all of this parkour and fighting, and they're just a mess, these kids. And they knock off Matthew McConaughey's weed farm, and he knows, oh my God, we're in trouble now. So he has to go and start working for Matthew McConaughey. He has to do two or three things. He's always very polite to the drug lord, and he's absolutely frightening. Colin Farrell walking around in these little plaid jumpsuits that they all wear.
Yes, he and his little posse. Speaking of the clothing wardrobe here, like there are these amazing, really garish track suits. Like each guy's got a different plaid track suit. I kind of want to watch a whole movie about them and their misadventures. Also, I love what Hugh Grant is doing here. I feel like he's doing like an old Michael Caine impression from the era when, you know, these kinds of British gangster thrillers were his bread and butter.
Get Carter, the voice he's doing is so,
it's so arch and so knowing. And I love later career Hugh Grant with these like broad comic roles.
Well,
so
fun.
How do
you feel about Guy's take? The character that he was playing is plainly gay. And he keeps
Hugh Grant,
mm-hmm. and he keeps making these sort of allusions and to Charlie Hunnam's character. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And again, don't not. It's not that it's politically incorrect. I'm just not sure what the point of that was, particularly in this day and age. If you know what I'm talking about.
Is it possibly just all part of the seduction of trying to get Charlie Hunnam to do what he wants him to do? I don't know. Charlie Hunnam is a lot better in this, though, than he is in
King
Guy
Arthur.
Ritchie's King Arthur.
Oh, my God, what a mess.
The redemption of Charlie Hunnam here. So I had a good time. Yes, it has its shortcomings. Yeah. I agree.
The Gentleman, from writer-director Guy Ritchie. It's rated R in wide release. The horror film The Turning is directed by Floria Sigismondi. The film stars Mackenzie Davis and Finn Wolfhard. Tim.
Adaptation of the Henry James novella. This has been done many, 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 many times for television and everything else. The best version is still the 1967 film.
61.
Yep. Thank you very much.
You're
we
welcome.
Were talking about that earlier. Deborah Kerr or Carr. Kerr,
yes.
Kerr,
yeah.
Inside of Kerr. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a terrific film.
Yeah, Jack Clayton film. Which is, you know, still pretty good. I haven't seen it in many, many years. It's good. So this is the same theme. A young woman takes a job as a governess at this gigantic Gothic mansion where she's supposed to take care of this little girl. And then there's the, what is she, the maid, I guess she,
the
is?
Housekeeper.
The housekeeper who's mm-hmm. there. And suddenly a little boy shows up too. He just got kicked out of boarding school. So she has these two children that are her charge. All sorts of stories are told. It begins with another storyline that I'll let Christy set up for you because I actually got to my screening late. But I got to tell you, all of this is about, it's just a ghost story. This is the difficult thing about ghost story movies. Right now, there are ghost story movies where the ghosts are real. There are ghosts there. They're actually there. And either the characters in the movie believe that the ghosts are there or they don't. And we as the audience are waiting for them to catch on that there are ghosts, right? And once you catch on, you're supposed to do something about that. It's obvious. This place is so obviously haunted. From the beginning of the movie, ghosts are doing all kinds of things to her. That thing on the bed with the hands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like... You, and you stay? You don't go home? After you get
Motels used to have those things with the beds all the time. You put a quarter in.
But there's a moment where I'm just like, oh, well, sweetie, you know what? Whatever happens to you, you got coming. Because there's plainly a ghost in this house.
Or is there? No, I'm serious. I think there's another way to interpret all of this because it ends very abruptly. I like this movie for a long time. It's got style for days. The director is this veteran music video director. Among the clips she's directed are The Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson. She did Justin Timberlake's Mirror. She's been around for a long time doing this. The movie takes place in 1994, right after Kurt Cobain's death, and that kind of sets it like in a contemporary but somber place. But
it also gets rid of cell phones.
It's the not pre everyone having cell phones and internet access. That's true, because if Mackenzie Davis had just Googled this house, we'd have no movie. But it's right before then. I am not sure this is entirely a ghost story. And the way that it ends abruptly is very jarring. It almost feels like a cheat. Like, we're just going to jump out of here now and let you all figure it out for yourselves. And I'm all for ambiguity. And I really appreciate when a filmmaker has enough trust in us as an audience to not hold our hand every step of the way. This is beyond that, though. This is just like, boom, it just ends. And I suspect that there is a whole other way to interpret this because of what is going on with her mom, who is in a mental institution, who we see early on in the film. So I'm just going to say that.
All right. The film is The Turning, based on Henry James' The Turn of the Screw. And the film stars Mackenzie Davis, Finn Wolfhard, Brooklyn Prince, Floria Sigismundi is the director. It's rated PG-13 and in wide release. The musical My Name is Maisha stars Rachel Walker. Gus Krieger is the director. Tim, what'd you think?
Well, this was just wonderful, but you have to stick with it because it's coming from a bit of a sideways place. It's adapted from a play called Dreamscape. It's specifically about the shooting of a 19-year-old California teenage girl named Taisha Miller in 1998 by the police as she was asleep in her car with a revolver on her lap. I remember this specifically.
Yeah, we covered it.
So that is at the center of this, along with several other stories, Philando Castile and whatnot, about young black folks getting shot. So this is like art cinema, part Shirley Clarke, sort of Cool World, a little bit of Chirac in there, even a tiny bit of sort of Blind Spotting, almost entirely in prose and in hip hop. As we listen to this young woman from her mindscape, mostly told from her observing her own autopsy, what it meant to be her and to reflect on what happened to her. And it gets more and more powerful as it goes, as we start to understand what is happening in the film. The young woman in the lead is just fantastic. She's every bit as fantastic as Nick Cannon was in Chirac, that Lissa Strada adaptation. So I found this deeply moving and powerful.
Rachel Walker is her name, and it's a tremendous performance because so much is asked of her, because she has to rap and dance and also be funny and have tremendous comic timing, but there's so many serious, darker moments too. I was really blown away by this film. I did not know really anything going into it. It is really playful with form. It was a play that they have now adapted into a film, and you can sort of see its theatrical origins because so much of it is just in her mind and in a stark space. But then, you know, in her autopsy, for example, the coroner is like beatboxing and then talking about specific details on, you know, the 12th bullet entered this part of her body. It's in all of the scientific technical jargon, but he's like beatboxing it, but there's also a seriousness to it. It goes off on all these tangents about black women's hair.
Oh yeah, don't touch the hair.
Yeah, and things that are so relevant and so funny, and you learn about this young woman at the point of her death, as she's reflecting on how she could have gone to college and she was a softball player and why she made this decision and that one, because you think, where else can they go? We know she dies. She's sitting there. Where are we going to go with this? And it keeps going into a multitude of directions that you would never expect. I was so impressed by this. John Merchant, I want to say also, is the guy who is the cop and the beatboxer, and he's like some other character.
And the
medical examiner.
The coroner. Yeah, he plays all of those roles.
It's incredible. It's they accomplished so much here with what must have been a very low budget, I'm guessing. And it's very powerful.
We're talking about the musical drama My Name is Maisha, starring Rachel Walker. Gus Krieger directed it. He co-wrote the screenplay as well with Rickerby Hines. The film's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater. We have many more films to talk about on Film Week, but I do want to remind you to join us coming up next Sunday, 11 in the morning, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A., the 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. All of our critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel will have clips of the Oscar nominated films. It's going to be a wonderful midday, starting earlier because of Super Bowl Sunday, 11 in the morning, and tickets are available kpecc.org/in-person. You can still make your Super Bowl party and know that you have a great time looking at the Oscar contenders just a week before the awards are given out in Hollywood. So please join us for that, kpcc.org/in-person. Coming up, we'll hear about the sci-fi film Color Out of Space, based on an H.P. Lovecraft short story. Those and more in just 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire with us as well. Next up, the sci-fi horror film Color Out of Space. It's based on an H.P. Lovecraft short story adapted by Scarlett Amaris and Richard Stanley. Stanley directed the film, which stars Nicolas Cage, Jolie Richardson, and Madeline Arthur. Tim?
Yeah, Lovecraft fans loving this movie did very well at the Lovecraft Horror Fest. It's an actual thing. From the producers of Mandy, a previous Nick Cage film from about a year ago, it's just about the craziest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I know. Our Christy.
That review was so much fun.
I love Mandy. Baby.
I know.
Dude, it's nuts.
And it's not that I don't appreciate Mandy, but man, this is challenging it for the crazy trophy. It's going for it. So we have this family that live in this sort of beautiful bucolic sort of forest land. And when I first started watching this movie, when I was looking at it, it's all these trees and everything, moss growing over everything. I thought to myself, this is the worst production design I've ever seen. And then slowly I started to realize, no, they mean it to look like this. Nick Cage and his family, Jolie Richardson and his daughter and son living here, a meteor falls in their front yard. Aside from the fact that if a meteor falls in your front yard, it's going to wipe out everything there. We'll skip that for a second. This crazy meteor with all these colors falls in the front yard. It dissipates overnight and crazy starts to happen the next day. All these plants growing, these beautiful, beautiful colors and this sort of purplish violet haze that comes out of this meteor. Here's the problem. The haze contains, I think, some sort of alien force, although we're never really quite sure. It drives everybody crazy, and it causes, well, I'm not even going to talk about what it causes to happen to Jolie Richardson. That's a mess. But it makes Nick Cage hit the real, and you can tell because he's wearing his crazy guy hair. You could tell Nick Cage, the guy he's playing, by the hair that he's wearing.
When he has hair, it usually means crazy.
Exactly. And he's wearing, I saw the hair, I'm like, he's going to play the crazy guy. And he goes flat out bananas in this movie. And yes, there's a certain amount of fun when that happens. But does it actually make for cinema? No, I don't think so, guys. I don't think so.
Color Out of Space, the film's unrated in select theaters. The Last Full Measure stars Sebastian Stan, Christopher Plummer, who's at 91 working consistently, William Hurt in the cast, and it's written and directed by Todd Robinson. Christy?
This is inspired by the true story of an Air Force parajumper who saved many, many lives and during a particularly deadly battle in Vietnam. A couple decades later, the film, most of it takes place in 1999, so like 3 decades later, the gentleman's former comrades all lobby the Defense Department to give him a higher honor, to give him the Medal of Honor. He's gotten the Air Force Cross, but they think he deserves the absolute highest Medal of Honor. Sebastian Stan is the person, the Pentagon staffer, into whose lap this assignment falls. And he is young and he's ambitious and he just has no time for it. He's on his way up. He's schmoozing. This is a pain in his butt. He doesn't want to deal with it. But it's like one last thing he has to do before he can move on to the next job that's probably waiting for him. And the deeper he gets into it and the more he interviews all of the other Air Force people who and other soldiers.
Yeah.
There were Army people that he saved.
Yeah,
right?
There were Army people that he saved. They were on the ground. It was just a horrible nightmare that they were in. They were really in the thick of it, and they couldn't take care of the wounded. He was basically a medic, and he rappels down into the middle of it and starts taking care of those soldiers and put them on the retrieval gurney and getting them out of there. He could have left, but he won't leave. And he stays and he stays and he stays and eventually he dies.
Right. So Sebastian Stan has to go around to all these people and it's an incredible cast. It's like
Samuel L. Jackson.
Samuel L. Jackson, Ed Harris, Peter Fonda, William Hurt,
yeah.
Bradley Whitford plays essentially, you know, your West Wing Bradley Whitford walking and talking political operative. But it's an incredible cast. And so Sebastian Stan realizes, okay, this is an important assignment and I have to actually take time and do this. And it's very earnest. And it's very safe. And everyone explains everything that they're thinking in the most poignant way every time. It's very predictable and expected. The music swells right when it should. It's a couple hours long. It's maybe a little longer than it needs to be. Having said that, even though everyone's talking throughout the entire film about how angelic and heroic this gentleman was, I never really felt like I knew him.
Yeah.
Like, as a person, as a complicated human being, like a multifaceted individual, there's not much to him beyond just this heroism, which is, you know, lovely and all, but doesn't make us feel like we know him at all.
He was a very young man when he dies. Christopher Plummer playing his parents. It's a moving film, but earnest is the exact correct word. Very earnest.
Last Full Measure, rated R in select theaters. Secret Zoo, South Korean comedy, directed by Son Jae-jong, who co-wrote the film. It's unrated. Christy?
This is also about a young, ambitious staffer on his way up who gets an assignment that he does not realize is going to be more important. I just realized that. This is like a little double feature. These two make sense. So but this young associate at this big law firm, and he's really ambitious, and he wants to get a more senior position. But they stick him in this zoo to be this failing zoo, and they want him to be the administrator of it, basically just to sort of babysit it until it can be sold and become a giant resort. And as he spends more time there, he realizes, oh, I kind of want to help save this zoo. But what happens is, because the zoo is in such trouble, there are no actual animals left. So like the remaining four or five staffers put on like head-to-toe animal costumes, and they go into the pens and like pretend to be a polar bear, pretend to be a gorilla, pretend to be a giraffe. And I laughed the whole way through. It's this really silly farce. They play it totally straight. They care so deeply about getting their lion or their sloth performance down just right. And like kindergarten classes come through and they point, oh, look, it's a sloth. And it's very silly and very sweet. And I had a really good time.
The Secret Zoo, South Korean comedy. The film's at the CGV Cinemas in Koreatown and in Buena Park in Orange County. Secret Zoo is unrated. Quezon's Game is a Philippines drama directed by Matthew E. Rosen in his feature directing debut. Tim.
In 1938, Manuel Quezon was the president of the newly formed state, the Philippines. In 1938, many, many Jews were fleeing Germany, fleeing Europe altogether, seeing the coming darkness, and they were being rejected all across the world as refugees. Against all political ideals of his country, Manuel decided that he's going to take all these Jewish refugees in, and it's a big political fight. An interesting historical story here, not very well done in terms of cinematic terms. Got a guy playing a young Dwight Eisenhower here, and I don't know, he's not Dwight Eisenhower. The story is a very important one. He is a revered person for having done this, kind of a Schindler's List kind of thing, only with political implications.
Quezon's Game, a film from the Philippines. Raymond Bagatsing is the star of the film with Rachel Alejandro. It's written by Janice Y. Perry and Dean Rosen, rated PG-13, and you can see it in select theaters. Elsewhere, a comedic drama written and directed by Hernan Jimenez. The film stars Aidan Young and Parker Posey. Ken Jeong's also in the cast. Christy?
This is a very uneven mix of somber drama about grief and loss, and also wacky comedy about redemption. And it doesn't really find its stride till about halfway through. Aidan Young plays this guy who has lost his wife in the past couple of years. He's still living in the house that he built for them, this beautiful little cottage with incredible views and an island off of Seattle somewhere. And the deceased woman's father wants to kick him out of the house and off the land, and you know, it's time to move on. And the guy's parents, played by Beau Bridges and Jackie Weaver, are incredibly broad and wacky and shrill. But he finds inventive ways to stick around the house once Parker Posey moves in. He pretends to be her contractor. Ken Jeong is the wisecracking best friend. You know, and when it settles down and becomes about this guy and the Parker Posey character getting to know each other and unexpectedly connecting in a time of loss and grief, it's kind of lovely.
Mm.
But it takes a really long time to get there. And then the music is like jaunty and perky, and I felt very uncomfortable during the comedy portions of this film.
Yeah, wildly erratic in tone as he goes out on these dates, and he's kind of rude to the young woman that he goes out on the date with because of Parker Posey. So yeah, that's the problem with this movie. It's just wildly erratic in tone. It needed to pick a lane. lane and stay in the lane.
It's written and directed by Hernan Jimenez. The film Elsewhere is rated R at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. The French fantasy drama Zombie Child is written and directed by Bertrand Bonello. Tim.
Yeah, Bertrand, he makes some very interesting films. He made one a few years ago called House of Tolerance about prostitution, and it's really, really this brutal film, and he was accused of being fairly misogynistic and just in the making of the film. Just if you make this film, you're being sort of misogynistic, and frankly, I kind of felt the same way. This film, though, is sort of about colonial colonization. So, true story. There's a fellow named Narcissus, whose last name I can't read. Claverius Narcissus. This is a true story. In 1961, he went missing. And for many, many years, his family never knew what happened to him. And then almost 18 years later, he returned and had this story about how he had been turned into a zombie. Now, this movie plays with the idea of this sort of magical zombie thing. But in fact, we understand that when this was happening, these things did happen. People were being given drugs, mostly drugs from the pufferfish. And therefore they were sort of under, and they were taken to the Dominican
Republic.
It's like
you're living dead.
And put to work on these sugar plantations. That's what happened to this man. So that true portion of this story is here. 55 years later, a young Haitian woman in a Parisian college, a Parisian boarding school, tells the story about her grandfather. And she's involved in all of these little spells and things that they're doing. There's another girl who wants her to use her Haitian voodoo skills to help her get her boyfriend back. So we're sort of melding together this true story with this sort of confabulated story of today. It doesn't quite work exactly, but I do like the ideas that are behind some of this, and there are some good performances.
Zombie Child, French film. It's at the Landmark in West L.A. and unrated. John Henry, a drama starring Terry Crews and Chris Ludacris Bridges. Will Forbes directed and co-wrote it with Doug Skinner. Christy.
This is sort of a Western, but it takes place in modern-day South Central L.A. Terry Crews plays an archetype. He is this stoic, silent, very muscular, intimidating man living a peaceful, quiet life, but he has this violent past that he has been trying to overcome and atone for all this time. He lives with his father, who is kind of randy and salty and wisecracking, and he's trying to, you know, live past this awful youth that he had. One day, this young woman who is a Honduran refugee shows up. She's being chased by gang members. She had been kidnapped, you know, for sex slavery, and he takes her in. And that forces him to confront his past. Ludacris plays his cousin, who is the gang lord that he had been involved with. Although I'm not sure how that works out mathematically, that Terry Crews and Ludacris are the same age and they're cousins that came up together. Anyway, the director uses all kinds of like Western, kind of like spaghetti Western specifically, images of, you know, the two of them facing each other and the camera's real low down by their legs. They're about to, like, you know, square off in a gunfight. The music is kind of like a traditional spaghetti Western score, but it never quite reaches its ambitious heights. It wants to be something, but it's kind of just a cheesy B genre movie.
Mm.
You think?
Yeah, what did you think?
C minus genre movie is what I think. But that's
I like Terry Crews doing drama though, right? He's always like the wacky muscular guy in comedies.
Yeah.
But I like him in a more serious role.
Yeah.
It's too bad to me, you know, having grown up in Southwest L.A., Inglewood area, that there aren't more films set in this part of town, South L.A., Inglewood. I mean, it's such an interesting environment and sense of place.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have Boys in the Hood, obviously, but not a lot of films that take us to that part of Los Angeles.
Right. No, architecturally, it's a great tradition.
Particularly rather kind of contemporary. I mean, Devil in the Blue Dress.
Yes.
But that's taking us back a ways.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. John Henry is the film we're talking about. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. Also, 55th anniversary screening of The World of Henry Orion, Peter Sellers starring with Paula Prentice and Angela Lansbury, George Roy Hill directing. Tim?
I love this film. Funny, I don't think you could make this film today because he's trying to seduce this married woman, Peter Sellers' character, which is kind of inappropriate. And this little girl, 14 years old, gets a crush on him and is sort of following him around. And all of that is just sort of like, it's kind of touchy today. Written by Nunnally Johnson, the wonderful Nunnally Johnson, and his daughter, Nora, who had penned the book that the film was adapted from.
The World of Henry Orient. And Paula Prentice, by the way, one of the stars of the film, is going to be doing a Q&A following the one-night screening, which is going to be this coming Tuesday night, January 28th, at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Paula Prentice will be there to answer questions and to talk about the film. Once again, it's 55th anniversary screening of The World of Henry Orient. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to be talking with the Frame's John Horn as he's in Park City, Utah for the Sundance Film Festival. John's going to fill us in on some of the most eagerly anticipated movies to be screened there. But I hope you're going to join us for our big Academy Awards preview show, Theater at Ace Hotel, next Sunday, the 2nd of February, 11 in the morning. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. We all hope to see you there. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. You know, The Frame has been preempted over the past few days because of the coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. But John Horn has been busy at work. In fact, he's in Park City, Utah, as the Sundance Film Festival is just getting underway. John, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. And if you missed us on the air because we have been preempted, you can always find The Frame as a podcast. So be sure to check it out and find us, because we still have been doing shows even if the impeachment has taken our place.
All right. Glad to hear that. So, John, what are some of the themes of this year's festival?
Well, I think if you look broadly, and I'm talking about both narrative and documentary film, you see a lot of filmmakers who are kind of wrestling with what's going on in the world. And some of those things are big ideas, like Hillary Clinton has a documentary, and it's not just about her running for president in 2016. It's about what it means to be a woman in any powerful position these days. There's a documentary called The Fight. It's about ACLU lawyers who are fighting against things like the Muslim ban and fighting for reproductive rights. There's a new documentary from Brian Fogel, who won the Oscar for his documentary Icarus, about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia. And then there's kind of niche, smaller kind of niche films. There's a really good documentary called Crip Camp about disability rights. There is a movie called Us Kids about the survivors of Parkland shooting. And I hope in all of that, there will also be some fun movies, because a lot of those things sound pretty serious.
Dee Rees, who did Mudbound, which was a Netflix film and Oscar nominated, has a new film out, The Last Thing He Wanted, based on a Joan Didion novel from 20-some years ago. So it'd be interesting to see, obviously thematically very different than Mudbound.
Yeah, but it still is exploring, you know, a political issue. This stars Anne Hathaway. She is playing a journalist who is investigating contractivity in Central America. And then she finds out that her father, played by Willem Dafoe, has been a arms dealer. And so now she becomes part of that story. It also co-stars Ben Affleck. So when Ben Affleck is at a Sundance movie, you know things are a little bit topsy-turvy. But Dee Rees is a really good filmmaker. Mudbound was about kind of Jim Crow post-World War II America. I suspect this movie will be political in its own way.
Josephine Decker has a new film, which is a biopic on the horror writer Shirley Jackson. The film Shirley, starring Elizabeth Moss as Shirley Jackson. Hopefully that'll be a strong film.
I think it will be. I mean, one of the things that is most interesting about Sundance is that so many movies come here based only on what the programmers of the festival have seen. So we know who might have made them. We know who might be in them. They might be really crowd-pleasing. They might be really small. And on paper, a lot of movies like that movie sound really interesting. There's another movie from Julie Taymor, who's probably best known for The Lion King on Broadway. It's called The Glorias. It's about Gloria Steinem, and it has different actors playing Gloria Steinem at different periods in her life. Julianne Moore plays her as an adult. Alicia Vikander plays her as a younger woman. So again, it sounds like it could be an interesting movie. You don't really know until you actually get to see it.
Last year, there was the multi-part, the long documentary Leaving Neverland with the two men who accused Michael Jackson of having abused them when they were kids. This year, the documentary On the Record from Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick looks at accusations against music mogul Russell Simmons. John, this has made news in the past few days because Oprah Winfrey, an executive producer of the film, stepped away from the project, saying that she felt that it wasn't ready, that there was more work journalistically that needed to be done on it. I'm sure that that controversy, that's going to be a big part of the conversation around On the Record.
I think definitely. And not only did Oprah Winfrey step away from the film, Apple TV, which was planning its distribution, has put it on pause as well. I mean, I think the question is, was Oprah, as some people have suggested, pressured by Russell Simmons? Because Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering have said up until the very last minute, nobody at Oprah Winfrey's company had any concerns about the documentary. Then at the very last moment, she takes her name off the film as an executive producer. Russell Simmons has been linked to a number of reports of sexual harassment and assault. And Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering have been in this realm before with some of their earlier work. So if Oprah Winfrey feels the film needs some more work, the Sundance programmers don't, because they didn't pull it from the festival. So this will be a movie that I think a lot of people were probably interested in seeing even before the controversy. And now they're probably even more excited or more curious about what is in the movie.
It's hard to imagine what leverage or pressure Russell Simmons would be able to exert on an Oprah Winfrey. She's a pretty powerful person, but it'd be interesting to see what the film looks like. A24 has a film, Zola, which I understand is taken from a Twitter thread about two exotic dancers, a trip to Tampa, and a film was adapted. Is this the start of Twitter thread movie making?
We've seen stranger things, Larry. I mean, we've seen movies based on board games. So if you can make a movie out of Clue, you can make a movie out of anything. I mean, I think that's one of the things that is most interesting about Sundance, is that where people find ideas for telling stories, there is a film starring Carey Mulligan called Promising Young Woman about a woman who seeks revenge on men who have done her wrong. There's a documentary series from Showtime called Love Fraud about a group of women who go after a real person who has conned them. So yes, you never know what the source material is going to be for a lot of these films. And I think that's part of why Sundance is so interesting at a time when all the major studios are spending all their money making franchises and sequels and remakes and spinoffs. At least there are original ideas up here, even if the idea starts with a Twitter thread.
We're talking with The Frame's John Horn. He's in Park City, Utah, for the Sundance Film Festival underway this weekend. John, I understand a record number of submissions, more than 15,000 films were submitted to Sundance, 128 films were chosen. I mean, it's an incredible job for the staff to cull all those films.
And they say, and I take it on, I take it as an article of faith that they're speaking the truth, that they watch every movie from beginning to end. Not so in my case. I mean, even at Sundance, I always grab an aisle seat, because even movies that Sundance programmers might think are really good don't ultimately turn out that way. But yeah, I mean, there are so many people who are making movies and they're submitting them to Sundance. Part of the problem is just getting into Sundance, though, doesn't mean you're going to get out of Park City. And there are a lot of movies that come to Sundance looking for distribution. They might be documentary films. They might be narrative films. They might be more experimental. And last year, there was a lot of buying. A lot of money was spent on movies that ultimately didn't attract a big audience at the box office. Movies like The Report, Official Secrets, Brittany Runs a Marathon, Late Night. So for a lot of movies that are coming here looking for distribution, even with new buyers like Netflix and HBO is probably now shopping now that they've launched their own streaming service, Apple TV, Disney+, even with so many new buyers, I think it's going to be a very cautious market because there are a lot of movies that are going to come here looking for a home. And because people got burned last year, a lot of movies may go home from Park City without a distribution deal in place.
Which is so interesting because these streaming services rip through so much content. They need so much of it. You'd think that even if they're not paying top dollar because there's not huge box office potential in certain films, that, you know, sort of anything that walks would be, you know, would be picked up because the streamer can use it.
You would think, but also, you know, there's certain people for certain films. And I think that's why, as in years past, there's going to be a lot of focus on documentary films. If you look at this year's Oscar-nominated documentary features, three of them premiered at last year's Sundance Film Festival, American Factory, which is about a Chinese company taking over an Ohio GM plant to make auto glass, Honeyland, which is a very unusual movie about bees and honey, and Edge of Democracy, which is about Brazil. All those movies premiered at Sundance. All of them are nominated for the documentary feature, and all of them have been kind of in conversation about having a real impact on audiences. So if the narrative features aren't working this year, I suspect we'll get a lot of attention on some of the documentaries.
John, great to talk with you. Have a good time and keep warm there in Sundance. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
All right, John Horn of The Frame. And again, The Frame available via podcast, kpcc.org. We'll be back in a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We were just talking about the Sundance Film Festival getting underway. And just wrapping up this weekend, closer to home, is the Santa Barbara Film Festival. It's on through this weekend. The Santa Barbara International Film Festival is holding most of its screenings at its home at the Riviera Theater in downtown Santa Barbara. KPCC Film Week and Christian Science Monitor critic Peter Rayner has been there to catch a number of the films. Peter, great to have you with us. First of all, is this the first year that they've had their own theater for most of the screenings?
No, they have about four theaters that they rotate with, you know, the Arlington, the Riviera, the Metro, and, you know, so they're still kind of working it out that way. It's several weeks earlier than usual, the timing of the festival, because the Oscars are earlier, and Sundance is happening, you know, like tomorrow. Tonight is the opening night of Sundance, so it's kind of a crunch, but I think it's a one-time-only thing.
All right. Peter, let's talk first of all about the theme of the festival or some of the awards. Who are the people that are being honored?
Well, they had Renee Zellweger, Scarlett Johansson, and Adam Driver. I was there for Lupita Nyong'o and Brad Pitt and Laura Dern. Tonight is the director of Parasite, the ever-present Bong Joon-ho. I have a great headline, by the way, for anybody who wants to just Bong hit.
there you go. All right. So you've seen a number of films, and a couple of them made a strong impression on you. Let's talk about William Nicholson's movie, Hope Gap, starring Annette Bening and Bill Nighy. What's the film about?
Yeah, it's about a marriage on the rocks. Their son visits for the week, and it turns out that, you know, he's in the middle of a separation that's going on, and it's low key. It's very British. William Nicholson wrote and directed Shadowlands. You may remember the C.S. Lewis movie with Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. And it's a very good low key movie. The acting is terrific, as you might imagine. I mean, those two. You know, it just really, plus Josh O'Connor, who plays the son, are all terrific. Annette Bening, has she ever given a bad performance?
Not that I'm aware of.
You know, I mean, and Bill Nighy, I mean, it's such a cliche, but, you know, it's another one of these masterclass acting movies, you know, like Two Popes, where, you know, you just sort of relish the timing and everything that goes into these performances. So it's played a bit on the festival circuit. I think it was in Toronto, and, you know, it's the kind of movie that doesn't grab you, and so I don't know if distributors are really, you know, hot and heavy to promote it, but it will be out during the year, and certainly worth seeing because of the acting.
U.S. Premiere is going to be in early March for Hope Gap, the film written and directed by William Nicholson. You also really liked a documentary about Scotch whiskey. I can't wait to see this one, The Amber Light.
Yeah, it's the director's Adam Park. There's a guy named Dave Broom who's a sort of, you know, Scotch expert, whiskey expert, and so he's sort of our guide through the history of Scotch in Scotland, and it's it brings up the whole. I mean, the history of Scotch is also the history of Scotland in a way, and you know, the discussion about the culture and the folklore. There's a lot of folk singing in the film, ways of bringing people together, you know, in rather obvious ways. You know, Scotland itself is ideal for making whiskey, you know, the peat and the barley.
Yeah, the peat,
and
the, yeah.
You know, it's all in there. And it's my kind of documentary because it picks a, you know, the ostensible subject is the drink itself. But it brings in this whole universe of folklore and history and you know to bear on it, and so you get a real portrait of the people themselves. There's so many different personalities, just as there are so many different types of Scotch, and there's so many eccentrics. You know, these.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's unfortunately they didn't hand out free samples.
That's too bad.
At the screening.
Well, and some of the distilleries, they go way back. I know from when I was in Scotland, it's just amazing how the history meets not much new technology in many cases. The Amber Light is the documentary. Now, you haven't seen it yet, I know, Peter, but Ivy Mirapol's documentary on Roy Cohn, Bully, Coward, Victim, that getting some good attention?
Yeah, it's, you know, there was this other Roy Cohn documentary, much more highly touted with Vanity Fair writers, that came out last year. This was in the works before that one. Ivy Mirapol is the granddaughter of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, you know, so it has a particular resonance, and I'm really looking forward to it. She's going to be doing a Q&A after the film tomorrow, and, you know, obviously this is a personal project for her, but it also, I think, keys into, you know, Roy Cohn and what he represents then and now. You know, it's been well publicized that he was Trump's mentor in the earlier documentary. So it promises to be really fascinating, you know, I think it's a passion project for her.
That earlier documentary was titled "Where's My Roy Cohn?" The new one from Ivy Mirapol, "Bully, Coward, Victim: The Story of Roy Cohn." There's no release date yet announced. And another documentary that you're looking forward to, "The Oratorio." You got about 30 seconds on that for us, Peter?
Yeah, this is produced by Martin Scorsese. It's about a performance in 1826 in New York that introduced Italian opera and changed the face of Italian opera in America and introduced Italian opera. And it sounds fascinating. It's only an hour. I don't think there's any CGI age reduction in this film. But, you know, obviously Scorsese, in addition to being a great movie maven, is also a great opera maven, and so he made this film happen.
All right, The Oratorio, and again, no release date's been determined. Peter, with the Santa Barbara Film Festival, obviously something that, you know, locals look forward to, does it attract a fair number of people that travel to Santa Barbara for this every year?
Yes, it does. I mean, there's a tremendous local following. Obviously, you know, Brad Pitt was feted last night, and so it was, you know, overflow crowds. But you know, in general, the audiences are very strong for all types of films here. And you do have people who come up from L.A. Some of them are, you know, entourages with movie stars and so forth. But there are other people who just, you know, love being here for a weekend or whatever and you know, and catching some films, you know, like Oratorio or the Roy Cohn film that, you know, will be out at some point, but this is a good way to preview them.
in often historic venues. Peter, thanks so much. We appreciate your joining us from beautiful Santa Barbara and sharing with us about the Santa Barbara International Film Festival and all the various screenings that are taking part. Thank you for joining us for Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. By the way, we hope we'll see you in person coming up just next Sunday, February 2nd, 11 in the morning at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A., the 18th Annual Film Week Academy Awards Preview. All of our critics on stage will talk about the major Oscar categories. We'll watch clips of the Oscar-nominated films. There are tickets available. Visit kpecc.org/in-person. And again, we hope to see you Sunday, February 2nd. That's just next Sunday, earlier than usual because of that earlier Oscar date this year, Theater at Ace Hotel. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week on KPECC.